You're listening to the Unheralded News and Review and Pharisee Watch, brought to you by We Hold These Truths. Each week, we look into the events that are, for the most part, ignored or overlooked by the mainstream media, and we analyze these events. Just as in Jesus' day, Pharisees still walk the earth. Among them today are the celebrity Christians who support wars in the Middle East to protect Israel. In our Pharisee Watch portion of the program, we feature stories about the unchristlike acts of these modern-day Pharisees. Our programs are led by Charles E. Carlson, the founder of We Hold These Truths and author and editor of the Pharisee Watch, and unheralded news features on our website, WHTT.org. Joining Chuck are four other founders of We Hold These Truths. Travis Steele is the owner of Steele Engineering. Mark Horton is the president of Ultra Clean Corporation. Chuck McCollum is the owner of Oakshade Development. And Tom Compton is a retired sales engineer and your announcer. Our reader is We Hold These Truths faithful volunteer and dramatist Leslie Ford. Welcome to our podcast.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to our podcast. This is your announcer, Tom Compton. We're going to be talking about Egypt again, and one of the things that relates to this is foreign aid. Chuck?
Thank you. We did this article, and Leslie will be reading it. I want you to be thinking as you listen to it about what Jesus would say about America's position, about the way we spend our people's money for foreign aid, why these bad guys stay in power, and perhaps why we have only bad friends as a USA. Why can't the Egyptians get rid of their lifelong dictator? These are the questions that we would want to think about in the context of loving one's brother and having a responsibility for the least of these thy brothers, as Jesus said in Matthew 24. Leslie?
Foreign Aid, The Sly Hand That Feeds Mubarak and Other Tyrants, by Charles E. Carlson. A lecture to Straight Gate Ecclesia, February 8, 2011. Good evening, brothers and followers of Jesus' teaching. The standoff in the streets of Cairo, Egypt, has stimulated press coverage of issues rarely revealed to us. For the first time, Americans, even those who view Fox News, have learned undisputed facts, including these. 1. The Mubarak regime is a dictatorship backed by both the U.S. and Israel. Mubarak consistently sides with Israel, even against the Gazan Arabs. He has repeatedly denied or severely restricted passage of aid convoys across its land into Gaza. 2. U.S. military aid has kept Mubarak in power for 30 years. 3. Mubarak's chief of security, Omar Suleiman, now Egypt's vice president, tortured prisoners for the U.S. before waterboarding became legal practice at Guantanamo. 4. The Egyptians' revolt was triggered by high food prices in a region where poverty is endemic. The Arab people there are displaying bravery in the face of possible overwhelming force. Americans, especially Christ followers, should be asking why it is the policy of the world's great democracy, bridging five presidents from both parties, use our American dollars to support some of the world's most brutal dictators. Professing Christians should recognize and renounce their own tacit support for those who ignore the God-given right to life of all men. The 2011 Statistical Abstract of the U.S. Census Bureau, Foreign and Military Aid, reveals that the U.S. government supports dictators, including President Mubarak, and also supports revolutionary movements against legitimate governments. The largest recipient states, in order of money received, are Afghanistan, Iraq, Israel, Egypt, Pakistan, Jordan, and Sudan. They all have unelected governments or leaders elected by questionable elections. Palestine received only a small amount of humanitarian aid, though its 2008 election was freer and more similar to our own process than any of the others. Our issue today is how U.S. money is used to rig other people's elections. The 2008 Census Bureau reported an amazing $6.0 billion in military aid to Afghanistan and $4.4 billion in aid to Iraq. Both countries were conquered by the U.S. and have held elections run by the occupier, resulting in U.S. puppet presidents. Israel received $2.4 billion, by far the most per capita, about $500 for each. Egypt received $1.5 billion, about $21 per capita, enough to maintain armed soldiers at every tourist site and many street corners, as you will see if you go there. Gaza and the West Bank are listed as receiving $570 million in non-military aid, but all of this goes to unelected government, the Palestine Authority, and Fatah, both of which were rejected by voters in 2008 in favor of democratically elected Hamas, which receives no aid at all. Neighboring Jordan receives a much smaller $530 million, most likely an incentive to get along with Israel. The Census Bureau reveals that the U.S. craftily funds revolutions in countries that do not get along with the State of Israel, including Sudan. The U.S. support of revolution in Sudan is an especially abusive case of using our money against humanitarian interests. Sudan's Omar el-Bashir-led government has been under sanction by the U.S. since 2005 or before, so it could not possibly receive the military aid. It is considered an enemy of Israel. Yet Sudan, quote-unquote, is listed on the census report as receiving $199 million in military aid from the U.S. in 2008. How can this be? Those dollars, tanks and guns were, in fact, delivered to the unelected Sudan People's Liberation Army, SPLA, a rebel operation in southern Sudan, a faction working to overthrow the once-elected president, Omar el-Bashir. Our government used the pressure of these guns and tanks, plus sanctions against Sudan, to intimidate the el-Bashir government. Intimidated to do what? Intimidated to allow southern Sudan to separate itself, taking with it much of the petroleum Sudan has developed jointly with China. An analogy might be for Russia to militarily intimidate President Obama to allow Alaska and the mineral-rich western states all the way to the Missouri River to withdraw from the United States. Every dollar of U.S. foreign aid is printed out of thin air, most of it ending in the pockets of U.S. military contractors, all paid for by diluting American savings and inevitably resulting in higher-priced food and fuel worldwide. It is these high food prices that finally triggered revolt in Egypt. The documented history of U.S. foreign military aid tells the story truthfully when our press and politicians tell us only what they want us to hear. We can expect the U.S. and Israel in the background to use the pressure of foreign aid to attempt to broker the status quo in Egypt, denying Egyptians the freedom for which they are struggling. It is all done in the interest of Israel. It is up to us, as followers of Christ, to stop this abuse of power. Our germ of hope is found in the certainty that American complacency is ending in the mushroom cloud of our war-based economic dilemma, which will be our topic when I speak to you next week.
Okay, thank you, Leslie. And one comment I might make about my own paper that you should be aware of. We have found no way to tie the foreign aid directly to the SPLA. What we do know is that the SPLA in southern Sudan drives around in American vehicles and uses American tanks, and that the government of Sudan doesn't. The only reason we knew about this foreign aid to the SPLA was because the Census Bureau carried a report of it, in 2008, we haven't seen any other reports that said our government gave this aid to the government of Sudan, or the unlawful government of southern Sudan, which did not exist until a very recent election, and was led at one time by John Garang. So don't ask me exactly where the proof comes from that we gave this money to southern Sudan, because we don't have absolute proof of this. But we do have pretty good evidence of who's driving the tanks.
Well, Sudan was suffering sanctions back as far as 1997 when President Clinton bombed the pharmaceutical plant there because of supposed precursors for weapons of mass destruction. And it was a pharmaceutical plant that was going to be supplying and trading oil with Iraq.
Exactly, Tom.
And then they put sanctions on them. Now, the interesting thing, of course, how economics always comes into play, Sudan is the largest supplier of gar gum, which is a thickening agent. It comes from carob trees, the carob bean. The bean there is gar gum. And that was one of the items that was not sanctioned because it was a primary source for gar gum. But they did hit them below the belt, so to speak, with other sanctions.
In other words, so, Coca-Cola wanted that stuff.
Well, yes, whoever uses this thickening, I don't know if Coke is used in Coke or not, but it is a thickening agent for a lot of food-type products. So obviously they had some power there to make sure that that was not one of the items that was on the forbidden list.
Yes.
from Sudan.
Your point is well taken. Sudan has been under sanction for a lot longer than 1986. That's 2006. That's just the latest sanction.
Right.
And the sanctions actually go back to 1988, but El-Bashar was not in power then. And he actually was elected in about 1996, I believe. He got in office through a power play, but he ended up running for election. And we don't know how good the elections were, but he did get most of the votes and was reelected. Could have been one of those good elections or bad elections. We just don't know. The issue here really is that it's none of our business what Sudan does. And so why are we giving $199 million to a group that wants to overthrow this government? And by the same token, we're granting $2.4 billion to Egypt to stay in power. So I think the story...
No, it was $1.5 billion to Egypt, and you said $2.4
million Israel.
For Israel.
Thank
and, of
you.
Course, the latest figure in Israel are more like $3.5 billion.
We use those figures because, although they are slightly older figures than are available, a couple of years older, in fact, these things remain pretty consistent. And what's more important is they came out of the Census Bureau's numbers, so it was kind of helpful to have them give us a hand. It's sort of a case of the left hand in government doesn't always know what the right hand is doing, so sometimes you get a little...
Right.
Unexpected help from some other agency who tells the truth by accident. Anyway, so much for the Pharisee Watch, and we're hoping that it gets wide circulation.
Great. Thank you, Chuck. We've got some other interesting stories here in unheralded news from the London Telegraph. Egypt crisis. Hosni Mubarak loses control of state media. So there's some encouraging things here. According to the story, in a front page leader, the newspaper's editor-in-chief, Osama Sayara, hailed the nobility of what he described as a revolution, quote-unquote, and demanded that the government embark on irreversible constitutional and legislative changes. Over 200 Egyptian journalists on Monday from many state-controlled publications marched through Cairo's streets chanting anti-Mubarak slogans and holding aloft a model coffin. One of their fellow journalists was killed, pressed. Friday was shot allegedly by a secret policeman.
Yes, this is important because this guy, Osama Sarraja, was editor-in-chief of the biggest or second oldest newspaper in Egypt that has always been totally supportive of Mubarak. However, this does not mean that he's completely abandoned him. It means that he's recognizing that there's something more than a little bit powerful about the revolt that's going on. The thing that makes the Egyptian revolt seem very real is that it's not just based upon the whim of some party to get rid of a guy who's been the dictator for too long, although this is certainly the case. The revolt is follow-up on one that happened more than 2 years ago, I think in 2008. There was a similar street revolt, but it was essentially short-lived. It was over food, and this is and that was when the prices of food went sky high, commodity prices, grain prices, and we now are experiencing that again. And again, the trigger for this is said to be the shortage and the extremely high price of food for people that basically live on substandard diets anyway, and many of whom live on a dollar or two a day. And therefore, a small increase in the price of wheat or flour or bread, rice, even corn, is extremely important to them. And they simply can't make it. So that's what the real moving issue behind this revolt is. And it's the reason it's being taken very seriously. These people really don't have any place to back into.
Okay. Travis, you got an item there on the...
Yes. It's Who Caused the Food Shortage That Caused the Revolutions by Ed and Bradigan, MSNBC, February 8th, Food Shortage That Is Tipping Over Career Dictators. Editor CE adds, the food shortage is the firing pin for the explosion that will start Americans thinking. MSNBC's Dylan Bradigan said the Federal Reserve did it. He is right. Food and the deliberate shortage of it is the bomb, but ethanol, a criminal scam, not a fuel, is the trigger to set off the bomb.
That comment is by us, and I might add that is an audio video that you can watch. And so clicking on the site, you click on the site and you watch this interview between Ed Schultz and Dylan Bradigan, both of them who have programs on MSNBC. Very unusual for someone who is on that kind of a network to come out and outright say, as Bradigan did, that the Federal Reserve prints all this money out of thin air, and it is their money printing that has caused the high-priced grain and food prices. That was his argument. Schultz's argument on this, he tied it to Goldman Sachs and said that radical speculation by the huge bankers had caused it. Both of them are right. Goldman Sachs is part of the Federal Reserve system almost, and it is a collusion between the big bankers and the Federal Reserve that is resulting in printing all this money. So the guys kind of got their heads together and came out with a pretty good conclusion there. We hope everyone will listen to this little audio video.
Okay, great. Thank you. Here's an interesting item about Israel. This is from Haaretz, the Jewish newspaper. It's entitled, Unlike Egyptians, Israelis Support Restricting Expression. Sounds kind of familiar, just like what's happening in here in the U.S. with our Patriot Act and so forth. According to this, while the newspaper headlines the world over excitedly told of hundreds of thousands of Egyptians, most of them young, demonstrating day and night at Tahrir Square in favor of democratic reforms, a small report appeared in Israelis' newspapers. It recounted that in a new survey held among Israeli Jews, 52% of those asked agreed to the need to restrict freedom of expression where a report threatens the image of the state. The survey, carried out by the geocartography firm for the Academic College of Tel Aviv Jaffa, shows that 64% of those surveyed are willing to see the state limit the freedom of expression in conditions of a security threat. Similar results were shown on limiting academic freedom. And it goes on down here. The Democracy Index has shown for some years now that 80% of Israelis do not believe they can influence government policy. In the eyes of a large portion of the citizens, civil order precedes the right to protest and demonstrate. Moreover, 6 of 10 Jews believe that the police must disperse demonstrations even if they do not threaten human lives or property and only disrupt traffic. It goes down further. The Israeli public believes the authorities and worships security sources. It shuts its ear to different voices and prefers to shut the mouths of those who dampen the joy and warm of isolation and bloodshed. Netanyahu should offer his Egyptian friend political asylum. Mubarak will feel here like his better days at home. That's quite a comment here from Akiva Eldar in the opinion section of Haaretz on 7th of February.
Yes, and I posted this, so I might add, we don't know if the poll results that this man has quoted are correct. We sort of assume that if someone cites really hard facts that they're not lying and didn't make them up. In Israel, that is always questionable because a lot of lying is done in the name of maintaining their state. And so we can't exactly say for sure that these conclusions are correct, but they do make sense because Israel is a state that is not democratic. They only claim to be democratic. And about one-third or one-fourth of all the Israelis that live there in the giant part of Israel, representing probably now 90% of all the land, a third or a fourth of them are Palestinian Muslim Arabs. And the idea of suppressing thought is, in the opinion of the normal Israeli, necessary to keep these people from talking. This is sort of an admission of what we would ought to expect if we stop and think about the situation in Israel. I'm sure others have comments on this or thoughts.
I wonder if this poll might reflect feelings of the Israeli public in light of what's happening in Egypt, reflecting or projecting their feelings about what Egypt ought to do. Obviously, they're afraid of that situation because it doesn't portend good things for them. So I wonder if that might be part of it. Obviously, they don't want to see the same thing happen in Israel with the Palestinians rising up again. But I'm wondering if they think the Egyptian government ought to just crack down. Who are the when they say governments should restrict expression? Who exactly?
Well, they're talking about their own government.
Their own government.
Very clear. This is what they think Israel should do. This is their idea of the way they should run their affairs.
Well, here's another interesting paragraph I left out that, according to this Akiva Eldar, quote, indeed, there is no room to compare the Egyptian worker who lives on hummus and pita and has the price of his flour raised to Israeli clerk who is required to pay a few more shekels for a tank of gasoline. True, in Israel, they do not arrest bloggers for insulting the president's honor. On the other hand, Egypt does not hold for more than 43 years millions of people under military occupation at enormous cost to its security, political standing, and economy. Even the prime minister of the right, Benjamin Netanyahu, said at Bar Ilan University that this cannot go on, and announced his support for a two-state solution. So here, he's alluding to the 43 years of occupation of Palestine, and so that's a strong condemnation, but yet he would be like the minority here in the United States talking against going to war in Iraq or Afghanistan.
Yes, this would definitely be someone in Israel who is in revolt himself.
Sure sounds like it. Yeah.
The question is, And the question is whether his figures are right. But I think there is a cynicism there that everybody that goes there eventually notes, and it essentially means that might is right. That's what Israel is all about. You got to have might, whatever you do, to keep the status quo or to advance the Israel's blue line is right.
Well, we suffer the same thing in America. Might is right, although we have we're operating under the delusion that we're somehow morally superior to everybody else and that everybody's welcoming our invasions and so forth and all this foreign aid. And, of course, people like Mubarak would obviously, he's welcomed this aid for many, many years, actually.
There's another story that's very interesting. If there's no other comment on that, very interesting one. The Palestinians are to hold an election. Now, this is a big confusing thing for the American public because when you talk about the Palestinians, they think it's all one Palestine. Of course, it's not. There are little enclaves here and there that are all separated from each other, and the people don't get together very well. And then there's also the Gaza Strip, which is completely separated from, isolated, totally isolated from everyone else. So when our press talks about the Palestinians, or the Israeli press talks about the Palestinians, they're speaking about the West Bank, and when they're talking about having a Palestinian election, they're excluding Gaza from that, and they're basically talking about the Palestinian Authority, which is the unlawfully unelected government of Palestine, who was tossed out of power in 2006 in an election that Jimmy Carter went and monitored, and others monitored as well. And the unelected were basically forced into power by the Israelis and the U.S. and allowed to stay in power, and they're the ones who get this aid that's given to the state, to the so-called Palestinian state. In the Census Bureau's figures, they referred to that aid as being given to the West Bank and Gaza. But, of course, none of it goes to Gaza, and it is all non-military aid given directly to the Palestinian Authority, who then uses it to maintain their power. So this goes right back to the idea of our first paper that that we read, where we talked about how these bad guys stay in power. And here you have the leaders of the Palestinians staying in power the same way as Mubarak stayed in power by virtue of getting 500 million or less, whatever the number is. It's
570 million in non-military aid.
Non-military aid. That's all. That all goes, we believe, and we think that it's very reasonable to state that it all goes to the leaders of the West Bank, which is the Palestinian Authority, thrown out of office in 2006 and basically put back in office by the Israelis and American government. I guess the point of all this we need to remember as Christ followers is that in any group of people, and that includes American people, it includes our soldiers in the field, it includes our government officials, it includes anybody, you can always find people who will do almost anything for money. In Egypt, they found people who would readily torture other people who they didn't have any interest in for money. The U.S. actually sent prisoners to Egypt to be tortured. And some of these were Arabs, and other Arabs tortured them to gain the favor of the United States government. George Bush found people who would torture waterboard people in Guantanamo.
And, of course, this all was at the all under the altar of security.
Under the altar of security,
Because of 9-1-1.
You call it something nice, and if you offer money, you will find human beings, and some of them will be Baptists, some of them will be proclaimed Christians, some of them will be Arabs, lots of them will be none of the above. It can be anything, it can be anybody, but people do corrupt, and I would state that that is why people who are following, who do want to follow Christ, need to not be afraid to take action. We've seen some of that in Egypt, where a relatively famous Egyptian movie star who lives outside of the country came back. He was the guy who was the star of Kite Runners, some of you might have seen. Anyway, he's in the square right there, and he was asked if he was afraid, and he shook his head and didn't answer that whether he was afraid or not. He said he didn't care. Another party is a officer of, what was it, Google? A young guy who was one of the founders, probably, of Google and has lots of money and a lot to live for, perhaps. He's there, and he's in the square, and is staying. So you find people of conscience under all labels, and you find traitors and sellouts and torturers and killers as well under all labels. And this is the way God made us, and it's our mission then to keep that in mind.
So true.
All right, well, thanks very much.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to tell a friend about our podcast, and please visit our website, whtt.org. You will find a wealth of information and resources like the latest Pharisee Watch and Unheralded News articles. Also, you can order our new video, Christian Zionism, The Tragedy and the Turning, Part 1. Even though this video is copyrighted, we don't mind if you copy it, as long as you copy all of it. Then you can educate your friends and acquaintances about the dangers of Christian Zionism. Start small, think big, and press on toward the straight gate.